American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, October 23rd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to gather around the virtual water cooler and talk about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, before we get started, I just wanted to put the call out to folks. I say this at the end of all of our episodes, but if you can, if you have the opportunity, if there's an organic way to do this, please spread the word about this show, whether that means like posting about it on social media or sending your friends a text with an episode that you think they might like or something like that. Just anything we could do to sort of boost the listenership of this show and help justify continuing to make it. I love making the show every day. It's one of my favorite things about this job, but I just want there to be more people listening to it and enough people listening to it to continue to justify the show's existence. So I just want to put that out there at the top of the show. If you can do anything to help spread the word, we would really appreciate that. So Jacob, let's dive into today's episode. What have you been doing recently?
It's October, so that means that what I try to do every year is hit up as many haunted houses around Texas as possible. And this year, end up doing, I think, 8 around various areas of Texas. Wow. Some good, some not so good. And generally had a really good time. I want to shout out just a few of the absolute best ones. I won't pick on the ones that didn't move the needle for me. But a Dark Hour in Plano, Texas, which is right outside of Dallas, probably the best haunted house in the state. I've been there a few times, and each year I'm impressed by the quality of performance and design and experience. Just the most well-managed, well-performed, like bang for your buck haunted house in the state, as far as I'm concerned. They kind of charge an arm and a leg. The ticket prices there are kind of outrageous compared to others. But if you're like an aficionado, if you really want like the absolute best experience of a haunted house, and you're like you're in Texas and you want to see like, okay, what's the absolute best they can do? Dark Hour is kind of the place to go. If you're in the Austin area, the one I'm recommending the most right now is a house called Bat City Scare Grounds, which is in Buda, just south of Austin. There are more famous and established houses in the Austin area, ones that have been around for, you know, decades. But Bat City is the newest, and it's the one that's the most fun. It has the smallest budget for sure, but it has the most dedicated actors, and it has a team that seems like they really want you to have a good time. Whereas a lot of the other houses in Austin are very much like, they're so good, but they have kind of a bare minimum. All right, let's get people through this. Let's go. Whereas every time I'm at Bat City, I feel like, wow, this place like genuinely is made by people who love doing this. So if you're in the Dallas area, Dark Hour. If you're in the Austin area, Bat City Scare Grounds. And I'm hoping to hit up Houston next year. I haven't done like a full journey of Houston haunted houses yet, so I'll keep you posted. That's the niche Jacob Adventures for the day.
I love it, man. That's wild. So 8 this year, that seems like a lot. I mean, maybe it's just you do the same thing that you did today on previous podcasts where you only talk about a couple that really stand out to you, but it seems like 8 is more than you've done in the past. Is that right? Or is that normal for you?
I'd say it's probably a little bit above average. Some years a little more, some years a little less. I know a couple years ago, for example, I did SeaWorld San Antonio's haunted house event. I actually did it solo. I don't have ever done a haunted house thing solo. And I ended up only doing that one that year because there was 8 houses in there. It was like, you know, you went to one place, but there was 8 different mazes. So some years it depends on like, you know, where the money is, you know, or how the travel is. And like I said, next year, I'm really eyeballing, you know, checking out Houston or even like driving north into Oklahoma and seeing what's up there. I've reached a point where I'm starting to exhaust my usual haunts, pun intended. So I really, it's time for me to start looking into road trips to try to keep this fresh. Ben, I've started getting a lot of Instagram ads for Florida haunted houses. I have no idea why. So I got to ask, is this something that you ever do down there?
No, absolutely not. And I'm not sure. That's so funny that you would get them for a state that's so far away from you. No, I haven't seen a single ad. I don't know of any legitimate haunted houses in the sort of Jacksonville area, which is where I am near there. That's not to say that there aren't any, but they just don't really, the advertising, whatever advertising they do has not reached me. So I don't know, maybe I'll try to look into that for next year or something and get a little bit of a better jump on it than waiting until the week before Halloween to try to do that. But I guess along those lines, is there like a timing thing that you would recommend, Jacob? Like, I imagine waiting until the last minute before Halloween is kind of a nightmare because a lot of people would probably do that. But do you think crowds wise, it's better to do it, what, the second week of October or something? What do you think?
It's actually a really tough question to answer because most houses will have the most actors and the most resources readily available closer to Halloween. But there will be bigger crowds overall to accommodate that. So the question is, are you prepared to deal with bigger crowds to potentially have more interactions with more actors and see everything up and running to its fullest extent? Or do you want to have smaller lines, but possibly see houses that maybe aren't as fully staffed? And that's something I encountered in some places this month where I'll go to what's clearly a good house, but clearly they don't have enough actors to run it properly. Like there's one house that I absolutely love and I've been to many times, but this year the staff just wasn't there. They didn't have enough people to make it a fully effective experience, which like they have in the past. That's one of the reasons why I was recommending Dark Hour and Bat City Scaregrounds is that they felt fully staffed. They felt like they had actors constantly around you and ready to really play with you in ways that are fun. Other houses, my other pet peeve is that houses who train their actors to hit a mark and immediately retreat, like no dialogue, no improvisation, just clearly being told, yes, make your scare and go away. Whereas the other places are, the actors have a lot of freedom and wiggle room to make it a unique experience for you. But anyway, I went off a tangent there. Yeah, I would recommend mid to late October if you want like the houses running at peak efficiency. And if a house offers it and you can afford it, a lot of places will offer a fast pass ticket or a skip the line ticket. I personally like a little bit of line waiting at my haunted houses. I think that helps build suspense. And I think that going from house to house to house, skipping line every single time can, hurt the pacing of your evening. But if there's a fast pass option where it's like a reduced line, and like I said, a lot of places offer that now, I would recommend that. But like I said, if you can't afford that, or if you have a bigger group, not everybody can, I'd recommend getting to houses at opening with a regular ticket. That way the lines aren't as big. But if you're there 2 hours after opening, close to Halloween, you're going to be in line for hours and hours and hours. So
yeah,
if you can afford it, and there's an option for it, get a beefed up ticket that lets you bypass the line. But if you can't do that, like I said, sometimes some places it's a reasonable upcharge, and other places it's not. And if that upcharge does not seem reasonable to you, they say, well, the door's open at 7, get there at 7. And, I have in the past bought a skip the line ticket and arrived at opening to a major haunted house, and there was no wait. And I realized, I just paid $12 extra for nothing. So that's the balance I'd find. That's my personal advice to all haunted houses out there as you barrel toward Halloween this season.
Excellent. Okay, let's get into what we've been reading. I am in the middle of a big book that I'll talk about when I'm done with it, but you've been reading a ton of stuff, so tell me about that.
Yeah, I know we have this little doc we're following here. I'm going to bounce around a little bit. I've been continuing my quest to read all the Stephen King I have not read yet. I'm getting there. I think I have not that many books left from my unread pile of Stephen King. So I'll talk about three that I read in rapid fire here. I read Duma Key, Billy Summers, and Mr. Mercedes. These are all for the last 20 or so years of King. They're all, relatively recent, which is where most of my unread King comes from. And I like them all to various degrees. Duma Key is a more straight up horror story. It's a very traditional King book in that way. Modern King seems, he really bounces around a lot of genres these days. But when he decides to, hunker down and write a proper horror novel these days, it's always still exciting. And Duma Key is about a architect who survives an accident where he loses his arm and goes to live in Florida to recover, and where he learns how to paint. And as he paints, learns that he's living in a place, this island called Duma Key, that has very nefarious supernatural elements at work. And this book is very long. It's a brick of a book, but it's very scary, very emotional, and top tier modern King horror. Highly recommended. I can't recommend Billy Summers quite as much. This feels a lot like King trying to do Lee Child, who writes the Jack Reacher books. It's, you know, the stoic white knight assassin goes on a mission that goes wrong and has to go on the run. It's fine. I just don't think that King's not as good at writing these sort of, you know, heroic crime thrillers as much as other folks are. I get why he wants to scratch that itch, because clearly he has it in him and wants to write like Lee Child or John McDonald or all these other writers who excel at that kind of detective, you know, or thriller fiction. And Billy Summers is good. I just feel like King has such a special voice that I don't want him to operate in a playground that's not his. In terms of thrillers from King that do work, Mr. Mercedes, it's the first in the Bill Hodges trilogy. Sorry, a detective named Bill Hodges. And these books were adapted into a TV series called Mr. Mercedes as well from a few years back, starring Brendan Gleeson. And I haven't seen the show yet, but Mr. Mercedes feels more in line with what I want from a King thriller, in that instead of being a more purely heroic, like two-fisted, thriller adventure, it has a real nasty streak to it. It's about a retired detective who's being taunted by a mass murderer who he couldn't catch while he was at the job. And he essentially, you know, from retirement comes back out to try to find him, which is a very traditional setup. But the book has a mean streak. It's nasty and filthy. And the villain is really hateable. Like one of King's most memorable, like, dirtbag, evil piece of garbage villains. And I'm looking forward to reading the other two in the trilogy after this one. I just feel like if King is going to do a thriller, I want maybe just a smidge of horror in there. I want like the terror and unpleasantness that defines his horror to leak into his thrillers. I think that the more horror that can like grease the engine of a King thriller, the more I'm willing to like roll with King not writing horror, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I'm honestly not surprised that you haven't seen the Mr. Mercedes show, because if I remember correctly, that aired on like some super obscure channel or network or something that was like owned explicitly by AT&T and like cordoned off and siloed off into its own weird thing. And it was like, what, this little entity is creating original programming right now? That was like at the peak of like every company on earth seemingly deciding to get into making TV. So I think it's probably changed ownership or shifted to be able to be, you know, viewed on some other streaming service by now or whatever. But yeah, at the time I remember writing something for Slash Film and being like, Jesus, like where even is this? So yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, looking at now, it premiered on Audience in 2017, which doesn't exist anymore. It was a paid television show owned by AT&T. But it looks like Peacock bought the rights to the show. So all three seasons of it are now streaming on Peacock. So I think what I'll do is I'll probably finish all three of the books first before I watch the show, because since the show started when the trilogy was finished, they could remix it a little bit. So I kind of want to not risk spoiling future books. But
yeah,
Brendan, hey, I'll watch a show starring Brendan Gleeson. I'm down for that.
Okay, what else have you been reading, Jacob?
I read two very different pop culture / filmmaking books. First up, Kind of a Big Deal by Saul Austerlitz. This is a book about the making of and legacy of Anchorman, the Adam McKay, Will Ferrell comedy classic / masterpiece, if you ask me, from 2004. And this book tracks the making of the movie, its inspirations, and how it's resonated throughout the years. No massive surprises here, mainly because the making of Anchorman was pretty smooth, kind of a drama-free set. Everyone got along. And I think most people kind of agree that Anchorman is pretty great. I feel like the culture has kind of accepted that it's kind of like the definitive comedy of its era, of the early, you know, early 2000s. So it's a nice book. I liked reading it. But it's not like I can say, hey, if you don't like Anchorman, this will change your mind. This is a book that's very much, hey, if you like Anchorman, here's some really, you know, solid writing and dissection of how it was made and why it's special. So it's a good book, and I enjoy my time with it. But it didn't blow me away. But at the same time, like I said, most of the truly great making of film books are about sets that were disasters. And so there's something to be said about Anchorman being such a smooth, well-run set where everybody got along and everybody felt like they were, you know, treated with respect, that it can't necessarily lead to a drama-heavy book.
Yeah. Okay, so what was the other one?
The other one is A True Indie by Don Coscarelli. Don Coscarelli is best known for directing all the Phantasm, the first four Phantasm movies. He only produced and wrote the final one. He did Bubba Hotep with Bruce Campbell, the infamous cult classic, The Beastmaster. Just a lot of low-budget, generally very, very indie movies, almost all of them fantasy or horror, you know, over a 50-year career. And full disclosure, I did interview him about 10 years ago for the 4K restoration of Phantasm, and he is the sweetest gentleman you can possibly imagine. So open, so good with stories. He has the Kevin Smith thing going on, Ben, where he's probably only made a few movies I truly love, but he's such a talented storyteller and so good on the mic and so good at answering questions that I'm such a big fan of him as a person and as somebody who I like hearing speak, or in this case, reading his stories, that like I can't get enough of him. And
yeah.
Yeah, so True Indie is just him breaking down his entire career, sometimes being brutally honest, setting the record straight, talking about all of his movies. The chapters on Beastmaster are wild. Like, that movie is it has a cult following now, but it was a disaster at the time. And his stories about, like, trying to make that film with a producer who is a bit of a psychopath are truly great. But, yeah, so if you don't necessarily need to be a Coscarelli fan to appreciate this book, it's a storytelling strong. His anecdotes are really, really fun. It probably helps if you have seen some of his films. But this is a really, really fun read for somebody who just wants, you know, 250 pages of really good Hollywood stories.
Nice. Okay, so that is called True Indie. And then yes. What's the last thing that you read?
Last thing, actually, I have about 30 pages left in it right now. So I can report back later if it drops the ball in the final moments. But I read Conclave by Robert Harris. I'm trying to read the books that are inspirations for upcoming movies I'm looking forward to. And this is the new film. This is the inspiration. It's a new film from Edward Berger, which is going to star Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci, and have a big Oscar qualifying run at in theaters coming up soon. I think that as you listen to this last film review should have gone up, actually, a very positive review of the film. And the book and the movie are about the conclave where the cardinals of the Vatican assembled to elect a new pope. And it's not like a Dan Brown thriller. There's like, you know, no archaeology. There's no mass conspiracies. It's just like a kind of a low-key potboiler about the politics that go into electing a pope from the POV of the dean of the College of Cardinals, played by Ralph Fiennes in the film, and his perspective on, you know, what happened when he put 118, you know, high-ranking members of the Vatican in one room, and all of them have different ideas about where the church should go. What happens next? And it's really interesting. I can see how a movie can work because it really is a political thriller, except where everybody's a priest. And instead of, you know, a election for a president, it's an election for a pope. And everybody is trying to act like, oh, God's guiding us, but everybody actually knows this is a political game. And everybody, all these characters trying to dance around that and trying to, you know, depict themselves as being the candidate for the job while also being humble enough to make it look like God chose them. Is such an interesting like balance of how this must happen in real life. It's my first Harris novel. He writes a lot of historical fiction, like heavily researched stories set in real places and time periods. And there's a real air of authenticity about Conclave that even though this is a fictional pope and these are all fictional priests, it feels legit in a way that I really appreciated. And I'm looking forward very much to seeing the film. The trailers look very accurate. Although I will say this much, Ben, in the book, the Ralph Fiennes character is a 75-year-old Italian man. But naturally, you don't get a movie made starring a 75-year-old Italian man. You need a hot 60-year-old, a.k.a. Ralph Fiennes. So that seems to be the biggest change so far.
Okay, excellent. All right, so that's Conclave. And yeah, that movie, I believe, comes out in theaters, I think, in wide release this Friday. So check that out. Hopefully, we'll be talking about that on an upcoming episode of this podcast. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and get into what we've been watching.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
All right, Jacob, I had the chance to watch Transformers 1, the new animated movie from Paramount in the Transformers franchise. This is a prequel set on the Transformers home planet of Cybertron. I believe Brad talked about this movie earlier in the year on this podcast before. I don't recall if you did. I know you've seen this. Did you talk about this on the podcast before?
I don't think I did. I think this happened in a window when I wasn't on the podcast. But I was surprised how much I enjoyed this movie. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm in the exact same boat. And in fact, I think the trailer turned me off so much that I was incredibly surprised, because I was not vibing with that trailer at all. The comedy I thought in it was terrible. And in the movie itself, I thought it worked really, really well in context, which is one of the few times that that's happened to me with comedies. Because a lot of times, and this is kind of like an action comedy, family movie, whatever you want to call it, but a lot of times the trailers put their best foot forward in terms of the comedic stuff. And I thought there were a lot more sort of subtle jokes or quieter jokes that worked really well in this movie versus the sort of more bombastic stuff that they put in the trailer, which was really annoying when it's packaged in like a 2-minute trailer, but spread out over the course of an hour and a half, I thought it worked a lot better. Same thing with the visuals. I was so almost disgusted with the way that this movie looked when I saw the trailer. And I was just like, I don't know if I can abide watching a movie that looks this way. And then like 2 or 3 minutes into the film, into actually watching it, I just immediately got used to it and it was fine, totally, you know, moving forward. So I guess this is just a lesson to me that maybe I shouldn't judge trailers quite as harshly or judge movies from their trailers quite as harshly as I have been doing. But I loved the message behind this thing, which is like, you know, power to the people, rise up and reclaim the power that you have as a collective and everything, which is just like so unusual for an animated family movie to be on Front Street with that type of messaging. You know, it's incredibly rare for an animated movie, but it's also rare for just any Hollywood movie to have that message these days. So I kind of loved it, and it felt like something that snuck through the system because it's so unusual for a film to have that that driving core at the heart of it or whatever. So
yeah, I mean, I don't want to like put words in anyone's mouth too firmly, but it feels though Optimus Prime all but says trans rights to the camera at the end of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I would not be surprised if that's the thing. When you have like these aliens who literally transform, and like these characters are kind of kept down and like oppressed by a ruling class of society, and then they regain their power, and with that power comes the unimpeded ability to transform at will. It's kind of hard not to see that message as being one that's sort of buried in there, you know? So what did you make of this movie aside from just liking it more than you thought?
Yeah, the trailers are bad. They missold this thing big time. They sold it as a goofy kids comedy, and while it's supposed to be fine for families, and there's nothing here that kid can't enjoy, it's a really interesting science fiction movie. It has more to do with, you know, Brave New World than it does Transformers, which was what surprised me the most. I really enjoyed the relationship between Optimus Prime and Megatron, which has been really been redesigned to be a Professor X Magneto thing, where it's really hard to look at Megatron's mindset in this movie and disagree with him. He's 100% right. It's just a matter of you know, how badly do we need to burn things down to start over? Optimus Prime is like, whoa, we can probably work together and fix this, whereas Megatron thinks, nope, we got to start over from the beginning. And I think those are allowing that relationship to form the core of the movie lets it work, because I previously, you know, I'm not a big Transformers guy. I've liked it just fine in the past. I loved it as a kid. But this is the first time I've ever looked at those two characters and felt really invested in them. And Transformers 1 is a really cool movie. I'm hoping it finds its audience at home, because it didn't find it at the box office.
Yeah. And I think, again, when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, man, you got all these big name actors and stuff coming in here and kind of like taking roles from voice actors that are lesser known. And you know, why do they have to do this thing where they cast A-listers to play all of these parts? And I still believe that. I still kind of roll my eyes at that. But that being said, they've got a terrific cast here and they all did great work. So not a single person was phoning it in, which you can't always say that about big name actors going into animated projects. So great stuff there. And yeah, this was just a really pleasant surprise. So Transformers 1, check it out. I'll run through a couple more animated movies that I saw recently. I caught up with The Wild Robot, which has been talked about on this podcast before, so I won't really say much about that, but just a beautiful movie directed by Chris Sanders, who previously worked on the How to Train Your Dragon films. This is, I think, one of DreamWorks' best movies. And speaking of great voiceover performances or voice acting performances, Lupita Nyong'o is just tremendous in this film. Pedro Pascal is also really great. He was the one who I was like on the verge of tears a lot in this movie. I know a lot of people have been like, oh my God, I came out of this movie like completely drained because this movie had like threw my emotions in a blender and kind of wrung me out emotionally or whatever. And I was not crying throughout this movie, but Pedro Pascal has a line delivery near the end that really, really got me and finally got the waterworks flowing a little bit. So just a really wonderful, truly, truly gorgeous movie. Maybe the most beautifully animated film I've seen this year. So I know Ryan was raving about this because he saw it at Fantastic Fest, and I think he reviewed it for the site. Did you see this movie and enjoy it, or did you not?
Yeah, Ryan and I we both talked it up on the Fantastic Fest recap episode because, yeah, okay. It's really great. This is like one of the best movies of the year. It's wonderful.
Awesome. Okay, and then Memoir of a Snail is another animated movie that I saw, and this one I think comes out, it might be out in limited release right now, or it's coming out very soon. This is a stop motion, it looks like a claymation type of thing. I wasn't really as enamored with this one. It's a pretty dire movie, a pretty bleak movie. It's about a couple of lonely kids, basically, who are split up and live their lives separated from each other and trying to get back to one another. And it's just about like the perils and pitfalls that happen to these kids in their lives. So it's very realistic. It's not like a Wendell and Wild or something like that, you know, where there's like supernatural elements or sort of high fantasy elements or anything. So I don't know. My big takeaway from this is claymation is a miracle. And I feel that way every time I watch a claymation thing, which is not that often. But every time I do, I'm just blown away all over again by just the incredible craft that it takes to produce a movie that looks this way. So shout out to, you know, all of the people who worked on this and brought this thing to life. But yeah, just story-wise, it wasn't quite my speed. So anyway, Memoir of a Snail, it has some good stuff in it, and some great imagery in it and some great messages and stuff like that in it. But I would say I liked it just fine, as opposed to like really, really enjoying the other two that I just talked about. So shout out to Sarah Snook as well. She was people will recognize her from Succession, and she plays the lead character in this movie, and she is doing like voiceover narration for practically the entire film. It might be the movie with the most voiceover that I've ever seen in my life. And she seems like she's talking throughout the entire film. But she does a great job and she delivers a great performance. So Memoir of a Snail is the name of the movie. And then I caught up with three horror or horror adjacent movies that I wanted to talk to you about, Jacob. So the first is Audition from 1999. Have you seen this? The Takashi Miike movie?
Yes, Audition is a bona fide classic. I'm very curious to see how you, who I know aren't by default a horror guy, reacted to it.
Yeah, I liked this. I think the Criterion Collection, or I'm sorry, the Criterion Channel description of this said that it was like one of the most infamous horror movies of all time. So I knew that this has been on my list of things to see for a long time, but I knew that this movie had a reputation. I didn't quite know that it had that level of reputation. So it may have been a mistake to read that before I clicked play, because that sort of heightened what I was already expecting to be a great movie. But even removing that, I still think this was very effective and yeah, kind of like unsettling in all of the right ways. I mean, it's got some pretty, speaking of bleak stuff, it's got some pretty gnarly stuff in here. It's weird to think about this in context of, like, I haven't seen the Terrifier movies, but Art the Clown ripping people's guts out and disemboweling people and whatever. Like, it seems like the levels of what constitutes like infamous horror has changed a lot in the past 25 years since this movie came out. But because compared to some of that extreme gore or whatever, this movie is nothing, but it also, like I said, it's really, really effective with the stuff that it does lean into in terms of the horror element. So it's about a guy who his wife passes away, and he decides to stage auditions basically for a movie that may or may not get made, basically all in the long game that he's playing. All he's trying to do is find a new wife. And as from the pool of people who auditioned for this film. And the thing I was surprised about, Jacob, not to really give too much away, but I was surprised that he kind of came out, this character came out with it and explained the truth behind what he was doing at the point that he did in the movie, which is like, I don't know, halfway through or something like that. So I thought that was going to be like a big reveal, and that was going to be the catalyst of this crazy revenge or this crazy thing that happens to this character late in the movie. I'm trying to dance around spoilers here, but that ended up being, this character was kind of like pretty upfront about, for the most part, about what he was trying to do. And then these wild things still befall this character. So yeah, I thought it was a really interesting movie. I'm glad that I watched it. I think this is the first Takashi Miike movie that I've ever seen. And I know he's like a big name in this space. Well, so
you only have about 200 more to go, Ben.
So what are your memories of Audition? Where does it stand for you as somebody who likes horror a lot more than I do?
Yeah, it's definitely, in terms of the amount of graphic content, it's never won that contest. It's more about the handful of violent scenes that are there are intense enough that it's developed a reputation for being more violent than it actually is, even though there are comparatively few minutes of on-screen violence. But what sticks out to me years after I probably watched it last, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I do like it quite a bit, but there's a jump scare about halfway through the movie where, up to a point, the movie is pretty much a slightly funny drama until it suddenly isn't. Mm-hmm. There's a jump scare involving a bag where the film kind of signals the genre shift. And I think about that jump scare a lot. It belongs on the list of great jump scares. So I'll leave it there for people to discover that on their own.
Yeah, and I think we actually published a list maybe a year or so ago of the greatest scares in horror movie history, and I remember that one being on there, and I didn't have the context for it then and didn't even remember it until that moment happened in the movie, and I was like, oh my god, it like fully got me as a jump scare, and then I immediately flashed to, oh yeah, I think that was on our list of jump scares on Slash Film. So I'll try to link to that in the show notes, and maybe people can check that out if they're interested. A couple more movies I wanted to mention real quick. Cape Fear, the 1962 original. I'd never seen this before. I'd seen the Scorsese movie from the early 90s, but Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum star in this one. And Mitchum plays Max Cady, who is the violent ex-con who is stalking Gregory Peck's family. And he really has it out for Peck. And man, there's just something about this and movies like Pacific Heights with Michael Keaton. I think this is probably a more extreme example, though. But like those movies where characters are being right on the edge of what is legal and just annoying or threatening protagonists in such a way where there's nothing that the protagonist can do to stop the antagonist, because they're operating just within the bounds of what is legal, that really is just so effective in terms of a way to tell a story and get an audience on edge. And it really sort of highlights the social contract that we all enter, where we just kind of agree to not treat each other like psychopaths. And so, yeah, this movie just, it really got under my skin. And there's a looming threat of sexual violence in this movie that was just incredibly, incredibly disturbing to me. It just seemed shocking that this film came out in 1962 and handles that subject the way it does. I mean, they never really explicitly say words like rape or anything like that in the movie, but it is so clear that that's what this villain character has in mind. And when he comes into contact with Gregory Peck's character's family and explicitly threatens them, and you can see just how it would kind of drive a character like that completely out of his mind in a way of like, how the heck do I deal with this scenario, that this situation of this guy who is like operating within the bounds of the law, but just hell-bent on making my life as miserable as possible. So I don't know. Have you seen this original 1962 version of Cape Fear?
Yeah, I do like it quite a bit. I'll admit that it's funny because normally I would prefer the more subtle, nuanced version of which this is compared to the Scorsese remake. But if I had to choose to watch one again right now, I think I'd pick the Scorsese remake, which is one of the ickiest films of the 90s, but also a real kind of a blast to watch, whereas this one is probably a little too low-key for me to want to revisit regularly.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it's been a long time since I've seen that Scorsese version, but in my mind, the Juliette Lewis character who plays the daughter of the main protagonist, she's kind of into Robert De Niro, who plays the psycho in that film. She's kind of like, if not actively into it, then like more open to the idea. She still plays like a teenage girl, but she's like more interested in exploring her sexuality and like kind of sticking it to her father or something, and like is more almost attracted in a weird, repulsed and attracted to the psychopath character in a way that, yeah, like you said, it's just, it gives you this disgusting feeling, whereas that's not the dynamic between the Max Cady character and Gregory Peck's character's daughter in this movie. But so yeah, I think you're right. And I think that maybe Scorsese's version is like a little maybe tougher to watch in some ways than this, which I found like incredibly well done. But yeah, it kind of gave me like a, oof, boy, like I can't believe they were going there in 1962 kind of feeling. So that's Cape Fear. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is a movie called The House of the Devil. It came out in 2009. I remember reading Slash Film and being enamored with the response to this movie, which was, I want to say it was Ty West's feature debut. Is that right? Yeah, that can't be right. It was one of his early movies. But man, this thing really, really works even now. It's about this college student who is hired as a babysitter at this isolated house out in the middle of nowhere. And there's a lunar eclipse going on and some weird stuff happening in the air, so to speak. And she basically gets lured out to this house, and then some gnarly stuff goes down. But man, yeah, I was very impressed by this movie. It seems really, really low budget, but in a really charming way. So I'm sure you've seen House of the Devil, Jacob. Did you like see this at a film festival in 2009 or something? It seems like one that you would have been on top of from the ground floor.
No, this is what I didn't catch until home video later. But this is one of Ty West's best films. I mean, it probably neck and neck with The Innkeepers for my favorite of his. And even though it wasn't his first feature film as a director, it was the first one that really launched him. You know, it was his third film overall. It's the one that really launched him into being a conversation piece. And I think he's been chasing House of the Devil, I think, ever since then. He's made movies I've liked a lot. But like in terms of a pure Ty West slasher film, this is the best of the bunch. And I know you say it's low budget, and it is, but this is one of the very few films that like tries to replicate like the 1970s horror aesthetic or the 80s horror aesthetic, and does it like really effectively. Mm-hmm. There's like no winks to how this film's style is. Like so many films are like, hey, look at me, I'm set in the 80s, or hey, look at me, I'm like the 70s film. Whereas this one really feels like it marched out of that era. The attention to like framing and even like in the grain in the film to how the performances are modulated. It really feels like an artifact in all the right ways. And also just my favorite thing about House of Devil, and this is I'm trying to walk on spoilers here, is how it's paced. So little happens by design for the first chunk of it that like you keep on waiting for something bad to happen. And when bad stuff starts to happen, it really happens in the most ways imaginable. So you spend the first part of the movie just waiting, and like thinking, when do we get to the fireworks factory? And then you get to the fireworks factory and you go, oh no, go back. I love the tonal shift when the film decides to really kick in the gear.
Yeah, the tension is so well handled because without really spoiling much, there's a character who's mentioned who is off screen for a lot of the movie, and the babysitter is in the house with this character, and you know that she's in there with someone, and the movie holds for so long before those two characters come face to face that it's just incredibly effective in terms of like ratcheting that tension. I also loved the soundtrack, which features One Thing Leads to Another and the breakup song. Just some really good stuff there in terms of like crafting that 80s vibe. So yes, House of the Devil, really, really fun stuff that I think holds up pretty well. Jacob, what have you been watching?
It's been a while since I've been on the show, so I kind of want to hit up the highlights. I'm not going to go on everything I watched, otherwise we'll be here for an hour. But briefly, I think you all saw this. How did you feel about Saturday Night, the Saturday Night Live movie? I know Brad loved, but he's our SNL guy. Because I had a real good time with Saturday Night.
Yeah, so I was hoping to talk to somebody about this, and I'm sorry to Brad if he's listening, but Saturday Night did absolutely nothing for me. I think it is a tremendous piece of work in terms of the production design and the costume design, and maybe even the cinematography, I would say, was pretty immersive, and it really felt like it put me in a time and place, and I think it did a great job at that, but I've heard Jason Reitman, the co-writer director of this movie, refer to this as a comedy thriller. And for me, the comedy didn't work in the movie, which is half of the problem, you know, for like that's a big chunk of it. There are characters who say things that are supposed to be funny, and characters in the movie are that they erupt in laughter or even sometimes applause based on the jokes that these characters say. And I was just like stone-faced the whole time. So that was a problem that I'm sure, you know, people's mileage may vary because comedy is so super subjective. But then the thriller aspect of the comedy thriller, I thought Reitman and Gil Keenan, the co-writer, kind of cut the legs out from under themselves by framing the movie in the way that they did, where like they've removed all the tension of what, you know, we know that it's going to work, basically. So the thriller aspect, that part didn't really work for me either. So yeah, I just kind of had like a completely neutral to negative experience of watching Saturday Night, where I was just like, well, these performances are pretty good and it looks good. And they did a great job and you can tell they put a lot of work into it, but like story-wise and as an overall movie, I was just like, what was that? Like, why would you do that? So I don't know. Maybe that's an extreme reaction, but what did you think about it, Jacob?
I had a good time with it. I didn't love it like Brad did, didn't dislike it like you did. I think that it's at its best when it's just kind of being this slice of life, things happening quickly style movie. I think that it's at its weakest when it pauses to predict the future, which it does way too often. Like, poor Cooper Hoffman, a really capable actor, has one of the worst scenes of the year where he's pretty much has to yell at young Lorne Michaels about how, you know, what do you think you're doing? Revolutionizing TV? It's like, come the fuck on. But when it's not doing that, I think this movie's pace really works for it. I like the performances a lot. I like the chaos of it. I'm a sucker for the, you know, biopic style movie that fictionalizes what it needs to fit a specific structure. Like I think the Steve Jobs movie, the one with Michael Fassbender, is fantastic, and this reminded me of that, although not quite as good in any possible way. But I had a good time with this, and I think it's funny, you talk about like people like reacting to the comedy here like, with applause and laughter on screen, when if you go back and rewatch the first episode of SNL now, it's actually really bad. Like the show doesn't get good for like a few weeks. Mm-hmm. I think this first episode of SNL is full of instant comedy masterpieces is really funny to me, because I don't think any SNL scholar or fan would argue that any of the stuff, any of the sketches or bits like glimpsed in this movie are actually good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, again, part of my problem with the movie too, is like the film culminates with these two moments. I think one of them is Andy Kaufman doing this Mighty Mouse routine, and then it actually shows the first sketch of the first episode of SNL, and those just don't really play the same way that they must have in 1975 or 77.
But they didn't play it in either. I really recommend reading Live from New York, The Oral History of SNL, an incredible book where everybody kind of agrees, yeah, first episode kind of sucks. So it's very funny to me that the first episode is treated as like holy territory by this movie.
Okay. All right. Well, Saturday Night is in theaters right now still, if you want to check that out. What else have you been watching, Jacob?
I rewatched the original Suspiria, the Dario Argento film from 1977. My wife and I are big fans of the remake from Luca Guadagnino. We have the poster hanging in our living room, literally. It's like a movie we've bonded over a great deal. My wife had never seen the original. Whereas the remake, you know, is a very warm, character-driven, story-driven, very dense, 2.5-hour-long movie that's full of richness and texture and time and place. The D'Argento Suspiria is just a 93-minute-long nightmare where any and all sense of reality is thrown away in favor of nightmare logic. Lighting intentionally makes no sense. Characters act out of character just to create scares, where everything operates on the level of a bad dream and nothing ever makes sense or is explained. And that's why I like it. And it's why I like both Suspiria, is that they are completely different movies about the same thing. What if a witch coven operated out of a German dance school, and they go in completely opposite directions from there? But Suspiria, you know, still has this power to it. The score is terrifying. The lighting is amazing. It looks like a Technicolor fairy tale, even though people are being chopped to death throughout the movie. it's a really cool thing. And I know it's really famous, and I don't need to tell a lot of horror fans that Suspiria holds up. But if you are one of the people who maybe watched and liked the remake, or watched and denied the remake, the original is a very different thing. You could not find a more different movie than the original Suspiria compared to the remake. So yeah, maybe double feature those for this Halloween season. I honestly can't imagine two more different horror movies, but I like that they both exist, and I'm really glad I revisited the original, even though I think these days I give the edge to the remake.
Wow. Okay. So I've seen the original and really liked it. I've never got around to seeing the remake, but it sounds like I should do that. And maybe as we approach Halloween, I actually will try to do that this year. So excellent. Okay. So
are you generally a Luca Guadagnino fan? Do you like his other movies?
I recently watched, what is the one? It's not called I Am Love. It's the one after that. The one set in Italy.
Bigger Splash?
Yes, A Bigger Splash. Thank you. And I despised that, but I really like Challengers. I really like Call Me By Your Name. So I'm kind of mixed on, and I was like okay on Bones and All. So I'm kind of mixed on his filmography, but I really did not care for A Bigger Splash.
Oh, in that case, I can't predict at all how he'll respond to New Suspiria. You need to watch that so I can know what you think.
All right. Yeah, I'll try to check that out before Halloween and hopefully report back soon. So what else have you been watching, Jacob?
I want to run down a few new releases real quick. Ones that have been covered in the show before, so I'll be brief. I saw The Substance, the new Demi Moore, Margaret Qualley body horror film. If I had seen this before our body horror ranking episode a few weeks back, I would have argued hard for it to be in the top five. I love The Substance. This movie is gross and hilarious and just very surreal. I did not realize how surreal it was going to be going in, and how it extends the metaphor of the film into every single visual, where everything's broken down into like almost cartoonish abstractions of itself. I love The Substance. You'll be hearing about it more as we talk about end of the year stuff going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Such a cool movie. Just really, really going, like capital G going for it in a way that I don't think any other movie that I've seen this year has. So awesome stuff.
Well, speaking of movies that are going for it, but maybe in the wrong direction, Joker Folly Adieu. I was prepared, Ben. I'm Slash Film's resident Joker defender. I'm the guy who has stepped up to the plate for that first movie more often than I probably should, because everybody else dislikes it so much. I'm the guy who has an appreciation for the first one, kind of likes it still, rewatched it a few months back and said, this is pretty good still. And I understand why it was a hit, and I really, really like it. So I was prepared to be the guy who said, like, I like Joker 2. I like the sequel. I'm going to stand up for it. And for the first hour or so of this film, I was like, you know what? This isn't that bad. This is interesting. It's doing interesting things. In the back 90 minutes happened. And I went, oh, no. Mm. Oh, I see what happened here. I see why people hate this movie. Man, this sucks. Joker Folie à Deux really sucks, Ben. And I don't think I need to pile on to the corpse of this film because it's such a huge bomb. But the number of people who had to look at this script and say, yes, that's what we're going to spend $200 million on, shocks me. I am boggled by this film. I mean, I get Megalopolis, a film I also do not like. But that was a madman artist spending his own money on a vision he's been thinking about for decades. I think Megalopolis is a disaster, but I get it, and I forgive it, and I move on. Whereas Joker 2 couldn't have come at a worse spot for a studio that needed a hit. And the fact that they gave carte blanche to these people to do what they did is shocking to me. I am aghast by how bad Joker 2 is. And I say this as somebody who, like I said, actively still likes the first one. They should not have made this movie. They straight up should not have made this film. What a debacle. What a debacle, Ben.
Yeah, man. I don't know if I'm ever going to see this just because I didn't really care for the first film. And I've heard such universally terrible things about the second one that I just don't think I'm ever going to waste my time. So I don't know. Maybe if they decide somehow in 10 years to come back and do a third one or something, potentially I could envision a scenario where I...
They can't, Ben. They end the Joker franchise here. They definitively end it.
All right.
Ben, well, you want 2.5 hours of Joaquin Phoenix feeling bad that he was the Joker for one day. While occasionally singing badly in really uninspired musical sequences. Because that's Joker 2.
Yeah, what a terrible pitch for a movie. I'm not sure. That's just a really whirlwind of terrible decisions going and kind of like stars aligning in the absolute wrong way. I mean, I understand why Warner Brothers would make this because the first movie made $1 billion, but just, yeah, like you said, the idea of that script making it through just seems, yeah, kind of rough. I'm not normally one to praise studio notes, but like I've said on this podcast before, like sometimes having another pair of eyes on something can be incredibly helpful to make the best version of the thing you're trying to make. So
I know I don't want to be the guy who says, like, you know, listen to your studio, because sometimes you really shouldn't. So many stories of legendarily bad studio notes, but you never hear the stories of the really smart creative exec who says, hey, there's a story problem here, or hey, this doesn't work. Those are stories that don't get told. And there are countless people working in all levels of studio system who are smart and love movies and get stories and can go to a filmmaker and say, hey, here's how you can fix this. You never hear those stories because they're so commonplace that they just don't exist. Like to us, the modern film goer, who only get the like relish and the anecdotes of, oh, the one time I got the worst possible note about this movie I made, that would turn out to be great. Because nobody ever wants to tell this. No filmmaker wants to share the story of the time they were wrong and an exec helped them fix the movie. Who's that help? It doesn't make the filmmaker look good. So we never get to hear that. There's a reason why creative executives exist when you're making $200 million movies.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so I'm curious about this other sequel that you watched, Smile 2. What did you think about this one? I think Chris liked it when he was on the podcast earlier. Are you a Smile 2 fan?
Smile 2 is great. Chris gave a 7 out of 10, which is... I'm glad he liked it, because I know he was lukewarm in the original one at first. The more I think about Smile 2, the more I like it. I had a blast, which is a funny thing to say, because Smile 2, like the first film, is nothing but feel bad stuff. It is nonstop grimness. It is like, it's about characters being stuck in a helpless horror cycle, being unable to escape. There's never any hope. And yet it is so funny and so exciting and so scary. And I left the theater buzzing. Like I was like practically dancing to my car, Ben, because I had such a great time with Smile 2. It is an unbelievably nasty thing. The violence in this film is like not, it never reaches like the, you know, the volume of a Terrifier 3, but it really goes there in terms of wanting to disgust the audience, but it's counterbalanced by how good the scares are. Like there's not a single like weak scare in Smile 2, whether it's a gore scare or a jump scare or like just like atmospheric scare. Director Finn Parker just
Parker
Finn, thank you. He nails it all. I mean, he has such a smooth, steady hand. And between the Smile films, clearly he has a personal style. Like, you watch these movies, you go, oh yeah, this guy has a voice. He's not just like pointing and shooting. Like, it's like a James Wan thing. We watch James Wan's early films and you go, oh yeah, this guy has a style. You can watch a James Wan film, a James Wan horror film, and go, oh, that's James Wan. And I'm after Smile 1 and 2, I'm convinced it's the same case here, because there's something really special about how this movie feels. It's over 2 hours long, and I was gripped the whole time. I was either laughing or screaming or one or the other. Smile 2 is, you know, probably not the best horror film of the year. There are ones that I think are, you know, more audacious or impressive in like overall scope. But in terms of a great time at the theater, Smile 2 is really, really up there.
All right. I was kind of on the fence because I was really middling on the first one, but I've heard such good things about the second one. And I think your review just now has finally sold me. So I'm probably going to go see it this week. So you've done your job, Jacob. So.
Good. Well, I want to hear if you respond to what I did, which is, it's been a long time since I've seen a mainstream horror film powered by such bad feelings that I enjoyed, like actively enjoyed in a traditional sense so much.
Okay. All right. Excellent. So that's Smile 2. It's still in theaters right now. And then the last thing that you wanted to talk about is something I've never heard of before. So tell me about that.
Yes. It's my latest South Korean Netflix reality show obsession, Culinary Class Wars. I've talked in the past about how the Netflix produced Korean reality shows on that streaming platform are frequently pretty incredible and put American reality shows to shame. I don't know, how much of these shows feel like, in the same way that we can like look at reality show cliches in America and roll our eyes at them. I don't know if these are common things in Korea, like if like a Korean viewer can look at this and say, oh yeah, I've seen that 1,000 times before. I don't know. All I know is that the Korean Netflix shows feel so different and refreshing. And Culinary Class Wars is essentially like, you know, a Top Chef or a Master Chef or an Iron Chef style cooking competition where there are 100 chefs to start. There are 20 celebrity chefs, world-renowned Korean chefs or foreign chefs who live in Korea. Or in one case, a celebrity American chef whose family's Korean, go up against 80 local chefs, like chefs who are like just working locally or work for private companies, or one of them is one contestant is a school, like a lunch lady cooking school food for students.
Oh, cool.
And it just is like, you know, who's going to come up on top if we have all these extremely talented people who aren't known outside of their neighborhoods versus people who are known, you know, across Korea or across, you know, the world in many cases. And the challenges are really, really fun. The two judges / hosts are like they give such good feedback. It's really funny to say this, but like their feedback and descriptions to the competitions like really showcase how feeble a lot of feedback is on American cooking shows sometimes. And I had a great time with this. And like a lot of the other Korean reality shows I've watched on Netflix, there's a real feel good vibe to this. It never feels like it's pandering to cheap drama. It never feels like it's like looking in the edit to create villains. It's just, you know, hey, here are some really talented folks who like to cook. And don't watch it hungry, because every single time I watched this show, I had to go make food because the food looks so good. And 10 episodes, just if you've watched the rest of the Korean reality shows on Netflix like I have, no reason to skip this one. It's real good. I had a great time. It's very bingeable. And like I said, if I wasn't cooking food, I was scouring DoorDash looking for local Korean places to deliver, because it made me so damn hungry. That's Culinary Class Wars, all of season one on Netflix right now.
Amazing. All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about pretty much everything we talked about at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes. Also, Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. That really helps out a lot. Again, spread the word if you can. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. That would really, really help and make a big difference for us. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.